This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And every day, 55 million kids go to school in America in grades K through 12. This week, I suppose they're looking at the calendar for summer vacation. Our society, though, has deemed it essential that they all learn to read, write, and do rudimentary math. There is consensus that the schools be a place to learn appropriate competition, self-esteem, social skills. I know you're saying, hey, Hockenberry, tell me something I don't know. Okay, hang in there. We have a broad consensus that sports and physical activity are important, less of a consensus that art and music should be taught in the schools. Well, anything missing?
There are 17 million kids in the United States, 18 and under, who have or have had a psychiatric disorder that causes them distress and dysfunction. And left untreated, they're more likely to drop out of school.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and president of the nonprofit Child Mind Institute. He says this country is missing a huge opportunity and making a giant public health mistake by not having mental health services available at school every day for every student, not just in some special ed program. 80% of chronic mental disorders that we identify in adults begin during youth, just like the successes we see in adults. They come from successes experienced in school. Dr. Koplowitz wants to get a conversation going in this country to address mental health and a host of other problems as well. His experience as a child psychiatrist for 30 years has made him a believer that the possibilities for huge social change are right there in the classroom if Americans are just willing to agree that they are as important as reading and math and Band-Aids from the nurse.
Around 22% of the population under the age of 18 who have one of these disorders. So they're not hiding. They're right there. And mental health disorders, as well as learning disabilities, are barriers to learning. They make learning more difficult. And if we as a society would like everyone to be productive, I think it's important that we give everyone, whether they're in a wheelchair or whether they're hearing impaired or whether they have a psychiatric disorder, the right to an education. And I think there's a myth and a misconception that kids with psychiatric disorders are dangerous. They are certainly not likely to hurt anybody else. They're at higher risk of hurting themselves than the average kid. But more importantly, they are usually the ones who are just either more disruptive or quietly ignored and isolated in school. And I think it's really a matter of turning this around that would help all children. So schools that are using positive behavioral intervention support, these are schools where they have decided that from top to bottom, they're going to be focusing on positive behavior. In fact, every parent in America should try this so that when your child is doing something that you want them to do, that you've given a request and they've met the request, is that we label that behavior positively. Thank you for listening to me so attentively. Thank you for cleaning up after I asked you to, instead of focusing on the child in the classroom who is distracting, who's out of his seat and constantly saying, sit down, sit down. How many times do I have to tell you this? Are you deaf? And so schools that have refocused themselves on a positive behavior are amazed at how positive behavior goes from being the underdog in school to really the thing that everyone wants to do.
Does this require training of teachers? And is that what they're doing in Chile, where they seem to have a much more aggressive program than we do in the United States?
I think the important part is not only training teachers, it's using your school psychologist, your mental health slash guidance counselors differently, and making the entire school think about these disorders in a different way and saying, we're not here to be a mental health clinic, but we're not going to be foolish enough to ignore that at least one out of five of our kids are suffering with these problems. So just think about it. If one out of five kids came to school and were physically handicapped, and we decided not to provide ramps, we decided that we weren't going to let wheelchairs or crutches into the classroom.
For decades, that's exactly what we did.
Correct. And America could do better. I was very disturbed that when one of the shootings occurred in California recently, one of the candidates say, just get used to it. Disturbed people try to fall through the cracks. Well, that's just not America. America is the kind of place that took on polio, took on AIDS, took on seatbelts. And so this is a nation that is very capable of turning around this problem. It's unacceptable that we have a school dropout rate of almost 40% for kids who come to school with a learning disability and an emotional disturbance. If we can turn that around while they're in school, which is where they work, where we know they exist, where they come on a regular basis, we can turn around the high school graduation rates. And most importantly, we can have productive citizens. Kids who are thrown out of school or are suspended, expelled, are much more likely to get in trouble with the law, more likely to use drugs, are more likely to have interaction with the juvenile justice system.
At the risk of sounding argumentative, but wanting really to underscore the big idea here, let me just play the cynic for a moment before we go. Come on, Doc. The mental health system in America is called the prison system. That's what every warden tells us on this show when we interview them. We're dealing with it. We're handling it. May not be the best, but this is the system we've chosen. Nobody wants to change it. And, you know, putting a few counselors in schools isn't going to do anything about it.
Well, I think it's much more than putting a few counselors into schools. I think it's retraining the counselors we have. It means making an additional investment in retraining teachers. It's really interesting that if you look for Teach for America, these are some of the smartest, most energetic, ambitious kids who want to become teachers. And they really master the art of teaching kids how to read and write relatively and do math really quickly. And we find that when we teach them how to do behavioral management and how to manage their own stress, they become better teachers, the kids behave better, and the kids also perform better. So I don't think America has chosen a prison system that is really a mental health system. I think this is a default position. I think it's one of those times where it is time to really look carefully at this problem that we have that really affects every American. It's not only poor Americans, it's rich Americans, it's white, black, and Hispanic. These are equal opportunity disorders. And if we care about the future of our nation, both economically and I think ethically, we really have to re-engineer and rethink how we're going to deal with the mental health and learning disorders that our children have that present in schools today.
Is there a particular story of a particular young person who maybe motivated you to be as passionate about this as you appear to be?
Many, many years ago, I saw a boy who came to me begrudgingly, because very rarely do children come to see a child psychiatrist on their own volition or their own desire. And he was in second grade, and he was struggling in a very competitive school. And the only thing he really enjoyed was baseball. But there was no doubt that he was very hyperactive and very inattentive. And this was literally 30 years ago. And it was unclear, but I thought he also had a real bad reading problem. I went to the school to watch him, and I thought his teacher was really mean. And why? What I mean is that every time something bad happened in the classroom, she turned around and she picked on Jason. It wasn't every time it was Jason, but she was just playing the odds. And Jason was really demoralized by going to school. And eventually, I was able to convince his parents that he truly had attention deficit disorder. We were able to treat it. And unfortunately, once he was more attentive and he was able to sit still, it became very clear that he also had dyslexia, that he was just guessing at words. He couldn't decode the language. And this particular school was for gifted kids. And so he lost his seat there and had to go to a more regular mainstream kind of school for, let's say, average kids. And that's a pretty good outcome. But around 25 years later, I actually get a call from him. And he said to me, there's an economic tsunami out there. This was 2009. And I think I've lost my business. My marriage is in trouble. I really need to see someone. I said, fine, tell me where you are and where you live, and I'll get you the name of a really good psychiatrist. And he said to me, I don't want to see a really good psychiatrist. I want to see you. And I said, well, I'm a child psychiatrist. He said, but you're my child psychiatrist. And what was really impressive about this interaction, because he did come in to see me, is that he even felt, when he thought back to second grade, that here was someone who understood who he was and wanted to make his everyday life better. Because if we didn't do something for him, if he would have remained in that school, eventually he would have been so demoralized that he would have dropped out if they didn't expel him or suspend him. And so you can imagine how hard it is for kids to be required to do what everyone else does that is easy for them, but is super hard for these kids. Every day, they have to climb a mountain. And it seems unjust and unfair that we don't show them how you can get up that mountain, but you need some accommodations. You need people who really understand what they're experiencing. Because if you do that, then you turn school into a place where kids are running and want to go to school and are enthusiastic about the fact that they're learning something, and in turn, they have great academic success.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and president of the Child Mind Institute. Community colleges are coping with an alarming rise in students with mental health needs, but they are vastly underfunded. A 2012 survey found that just 13% of community colleges provide psychiatric services, compared to 56% of four-year colleges and universities. It's one angle in our community college series coming up on The Takeaway. Those mental health issues we spoke about earlier this hour among grade school students eventually, if they don't drop out, graduate from high school into college. The organization Single Stop USA has programs in more than 10 communities around the country. It's a nonprofit that tries to be there for financially vulnerable students dealing with the stress of college.
I was at a meeting recently at one of our Single Stops, and the site coordinator that I was meeting with was running late. And when she finally walked in, she said, "I'm so sorry, I had a student that was suicidal. Came into my office this morning, and so I really need to stay with her," which of course, absolutely, you have to stay with her. The student had been very upset, couldn't complete school, couldn't keep her job, and the Single Stop coordinator worked with her through suicide prevention resources, resources for childcare, work resources, financial aid resources, sat with her and sent her to several referrals, and I think changed the student's life.
That's Christy Reeves, CEO of Single Stop. Reeves works in tandem with another nonprofit, Wisconsin Hope Lab, which identifies problems that Single Stop responds to. Wisconsin Hope Lab founder Sarah Goldrick-Robb says college requires an emotional readiness that most schools don't deal with.
Well, some people choose these colleges as their first choice, and that is where they would want to go no matter what. In a lot of cases, people basically find their way there because it is the place and the only place that is accessible to them. And so what that means is you're going to get more people who, yes, are going through some sort of employment crisis or have gone through major changes in their lives, are recently divorced, and they're there to get trained so they can go get a job. And these have been wonderful places, frankly, for opening their doors to society writ large and serving them. But we're also at a moment when they are severely strapped in terms of financial resources. And so their ability to meet the needs of these folks that are coming to them are constrained. And I think oftentimes the students don't really know that.
How much do socioeconomic factors in community colleges or in the colleges that you studied bear on the need for mental health services?
I think that they definitely are playing a role. I mean, the vast majority of low-income students who go to college in this country go to community colleges. And the average income at community colleges is lower. The use of financial aid is higher. And yet, I also have to say that one of the reasons that people are struggling so much is that the cost of attending community college is a lot more than probably most of your listeners would understand or expect it to be. The average cost out of pocket for a low-income person to attend a community college today, after all grants and scholarships are taken into account, is an average of over $8,000 a year. And so you have a lot of folks there who, frankly, are struggling to pay that price. That's contributing to their stress levels. And when they need something like health services or medication, they can't afford it.
Whose responsibility is this? Do the community colleges understand that this is something they need to be involved in, like, remediation in terms of dealing with people who are coming out of high school, who need extra skills, some of the responsibilities that community colleges have taken on? Or is this just sort of out there in limbo?
To be honest, I think that this question of responsibility is a really hard one, because on the one hand, they want to take responsibility and help students. And on the other hand, they are not deciding their financial situations. These are state institutions funded by states and localities. So the real responsibility, frankly, lies with those who set the budgets for these schools to make sure that, for example, they can hire counselors who can help. You know, the ratio of counselors to students at community colleges, there is one counselor for every 3,000 community college students. At four-year institutions, it's 1 to 1,600. We do this thing in higher education that we don't find acceptable in K-12, which is that we devote the most resources to the schools with the already wealthiest people. And we leave these other institutions without what they need. So I think that the responsibility issue is a big one. And I think we would see a very different situation at community colleges if we said, look, you have the money. Just spend it on these things that need to be addressed.
How much of the problems that you're seeing in community colleges are a consequence of a society where there really is no tradition for offering and maintaining access to mental health in all areas of life?
Yeah, I can't quantify it, but what I can tell you is that some of the reaction I've heard to this report that we did was, well, yeah, I mean, who's not depressed? Are we really worried that people are anxious? That's so normalized as just a, it's not thought of as a real hindrance. It's just thought of sort of a fact of life. But we don't pay attention until there's a suicide. I mean, I'm looking at numbers here that really upset me. I mean, we've got young people in this survey, people under the age of 25, and at the community colleges, more than 6% have a suicide plan. At four-year schools, that's about 3.5%. I mean, a suicide plan in mind, and we're not putting the resources in place. How many of these folks have to follow through on a plan like that until we pay attention?
Solution? Is there a solution? Is there an institutional sort of change here? Is it institution by institution?
I think, first of all, I mean, even introducing mental health into this conversation about what we're producing, quote unquote, in higher education, these degrees, and considering mental health a factor such that we could get students on track with good mental health at the beginning of college and they would produce degrees faster, I do think that some of this is awareness. So I think there's a lot that we could do if we decided that this was a priority.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is founder of Wisconsin Hope Lab. She spoke with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
You can hear our entire community college series at thetakeaway.org/communitycollege.